This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasodhi. It is widely known that Malaysia is not a signatory of the 1951 UN Refugee Convention, and that means that the refugee status is not recognised in the countries, and refugees are seen as undocumented or illegal immigrants. I've been hosting this show for 10 years now. Nothing has changed. In the studio with us to help us understand this issue even better is Dr. Sushila Balasundaram, head of the Public Health Unit in UNHCR, and Dr. Hartini Zainuddin, child rights activist. Welcome to the show, ladies. How are you today?
Thank you.
Tina, we've not had you on for such a long time. I haven't spoken to you. It was in the early days of the bigger picture, wasn't it?
I know it was, but you know what? There are more people actually working on the same issues, which is sort of good in a lot of ways. So yeah.
Where do you think you've come over the last 10 years?
Okay, I was saying how there were many people working on the same issues.
Because when we first met you, you were championing the childcare children.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So much has happened since then.
So much has in terms of awareness on issues and the fact that child rights is out there in the scene. We are looking and understanding the different violations against children. And I think that's wonderful because more people are aware of it. But at the same time, we're still where we are in many ways, in that we still don't have access to services or programs or rights as we did 10 years ago. And for me, that's really frustrating and sad. But I'm still hopeful, which is why I'm here today. So, yeah.
Let's talk about healthcare, access to healthcare
for children,
undocumented children, that includes refugees. Has much changed over the last 10 years?
No. You know what? I say that with a laugh, and the laugh is actually quite cynical and a little sad. No, I've been working on the issue since we opened in 2007, which is 12 years ago, and we're still carrying children and still working on the same issues and still knocking on doors to get access to health services or funds or resources to be able to make sure that, you know, every child is treated differently and that they get the best care possible. And it's still the same.
I mean, in terms of education, we've made some progress for undocumented children,
we highlight the issue that access to education is there for stateless children, but how that's implemented is one thing, and it doesn't include refugee children.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Dr. Sushila, what are the statistics and trends on the number of refugees in Malaysia?
Currently, we have about 178,000 refugees registered with UNHCR. Probably about a quarter of that are children and below 18, and maybe 30% are women and girls.
Okay. And this number is, I'm assuming, underestimated.
These are the numbers that are actually registered with us. So there may be populations that are still seeking asylum and undergoing processes of approaching us to get registered. So this is the data that we currently have that's fully registered with us.
So UNHCR is another organization we've spoken to in the early days when it comes to refugees, and has much happened over the last 10 years. On your side, has much changed in how we deal with refugees in this country?
I think if you bring it to 10 years, probably a bit of changes has happened, good and bad. I would say the point where a lot of access happened for refugees was in 2006, when the refugee access was provided to Ministry of Health facilities with a 50% discount off the foreigners' rate. At that time, it was still pretty affordable. But ever since 2016, the prices have gone up way exponentially higher, much, much higher now. So while there is some level of access, affordability is a huge issue in an environment where they're not able to work.
How does UNHCR come in to help these people?
We have a number of programs. We as a UN Refugee Agency, we have been working with a lot of partners to deliver health services. But however, of course, we do have our resource constraints, and we have to prioritize what we can and cannot offer. But utmost on the list is actually primary care services. So in the very beginning, we already started some primary care services from 2008, working with a call to serve, ACTS, one of the first NGOs to provide healthcare. And then we went on to 2011, another primary care clinic was opened to support refugees' health service. This was Zuchi Foundation. And likewise, there were many other mobile clinics that were and mobile clinic services that were provided by different NGOs. So that's at the level of primary care to ensure there's some level of access to a very basic services, which includes not just general consultations, but also antenatal care, as well as mental health counselling. Besides that, we also have a direct support assistance for refugees going to hospitals. As much as possible, we try to assist them. Of course, we are very much limited by our resources, but we see what we can do in terms of life-saving interventions and urgent cases.
So how do you decide who's going to get a UNHCR card?
These are pretty much on the protection mandate of our colleagues in the protection division. So these are based on the criteria, of course, defined by our 1951 convention, that there is a well-founded fear of persecution related to because of the reasons of nationality, race, religion, membership of a particular social group. So we have to understand that refugees are coming from areas of war or conflict or human rights abuses, and hence they do have a well-defined need for protection, and we need to ensure that that's established before a card is given to them. So it's a lengthy process that's governed by a huge manual on refugee status determination. So it's not as straightforward as it may seem. So that's what a lot of our protection colleagues in UNHCR do on a daily basis.
So what you're saying is we are not signatory to the UN Refugee Convention, but refugees can apply for the UNHCR card.
Yes. In Malaysia, the Malaysian government does not have a refugee asylum procedures as yet. So, and they are not obliged to provide that in an environment where they have not signed the convention. But having said that, the convention is not the be-all and all. There are many countries who do not sign the convention but may have their own procedures in managing refugees, have their own domestic legislation in managing refugees. For example, even in Malaysia, there's no... not even a domestic legislation, but then again, in terms of healthcare, the Ministry of Health has been providing access to public health services at a discounted rate from the foreigners' rate.
So they're very grey areas.
They're very grey
areas. We want to accept them, at the same time, we don't want to accept them. Yeah. We can't make up our minds. Tini, what are your thoughts on this?
On health services?
Yeah, both. Just the recognition of refugees in this country.
I just think we don't treat anybody who's not Malaysian very well, and more so if they're vulnerable and depend on organisations or NGOs to be able to help them. It's not so clear. The mandate isn't there. They don't have access to information. They don't know where to go. If you're talking about sick children and families, parents are terrified. By the time you get a child going to a government healthcare centre or clinic, the child is already very, very sick because they have no idea what the diagnosis of the child is. In many cases that I've seen, and yes, most of them are refugee children, and I do talk to Dr. Sushila before we decide to help. Is the fact that, but you know, by the time they get there, they're already critically ill. We're talking about critically ill children, not kids who go in with chickenpox or measles, and we're not talking about those kids. We're talking about kids who are critically ill, under 6 years old most of the time, under 3 years old most of the time, who are so sick that if they don't get the operation, if they don't get the treatment that they need, they will die. That's what I'm talking about. That's the cases I'm here about. And it's dire. It's dire because you actually have to pick and choose who gets help because there's so little resources, and that's so wrong and it's so unfair. So while the ministry does say that we have access to health services and we have all these and you can get the 50% discount, the truth of the matter is if the child is critically ill and they want to have access to beds in PICU beds, etc. and stuff, you have to waive that 50% discount and you have to end up paying a lot more than what they say. And if parents don't work, which is what happens with refugees, they're not going to be able to give that child the treatment and services they need. That child will die.
How have refugees been managing all this time?
I think over the years, we've had a number of programs. When we had sufficient resources, we were actually directly implementing case support systems from our office. So on a daily basis, refugees walk in. We have like 50 to 60 persons come in a day for various requests for assistance in the area of health. And some of it are such cases, whether it's adults or who have had accidents and requiring a quick surgery for implants, or a child who might require a complicated heart surgery. And so on a daily basis, our staff is actually assessing such cases, looking at who can support, who can assist with some of the cost. And if we ourselves can't support fully, then we have to start looking at fundraising as well to help some of these cases, which is where sometimes I reach out to Dr. Tini and her network. And that's how we've been managing. But also at some point, we had actually introduced a refugee medical insurance in 2014. Unfortunately, because it was at a point also when we started the second company, we had actually pretty good affordable premiums, but it was at a time when they raised the rates in the government sector. So for the same amount of people, you know, getting covered, but the bills were costing much, much more because of the increase in prices. And at a time also when we could not make this a mandatory scheme, it was difficult to actually implement this as a mandatory scheme without the collaboration with the Ministry of Health at that point. So after 2 years or so, the scheme failed, and we have not been able to revive it at this point with the current prices in the government sector. So we hope that at least if we can renegotiate this in future, where there's an opportunity comes up for that, this may be a more sustainable way of actually looking at support for refugees. And they have been contributing themselves to this scheme as well.
The thing is, it's not just the refugees who are having issues with access to health services and getting the operations and you know, and programs and things, medicines that they need. It's really the B40. You know, you can have a Malaysian parent who's a teacher and a police officer, you know, with a child with pediatric leukemia, but the truth of the matter is it's not free. Chemotherapy is not free. You still have to pay. And, you know, if a child needs, you know, 6 to 8 cycles of chemotherapy, that's a lot of money. The Malaysian parents would have an opportunity to pay in installments, but it's still a lot more than what they can afford. And a refugee or a migrant or a stateless child, it's double, triple that for each cycle of chemotherapy. One cycle could be 15,000 ringgit per cycle for chemotherapy. They need 8 cycles. You figure out that's $100,000+. That's just the chemotherapy, not the bone marrow transplant, which is another 300,000. You can't afford this. No one can B40. And we need to figure out ways to help the Ministry of Health, help the government be able to provide, you know, some kind of support and help and financial aid and resources to help the poorest of the poor and to help the most vulnerable. And this is what we're here to talk about. I'm not here to just criticize the government. I'm just saying, you know, please allow us access to and help to be able to provide for those who cannot afford.
It's bursting. I think our healthcare system, public healthcare system, is bursting at its seams.
Yeah.
And it's we have no more time. We have to implement a national healthcare financing scheme like yesterday.
Yes.
I think that's the only way, you know, there's going to be equitable access to healthcare.
And I think one of the challenges is that for populations that are not Malaysians, I think we need to explore how much they can actually contribute to their own healthcare, because I think refugees in our past insurance scheme have contributed. 60% of the scheme was actually contributed by refugees themselves in an environment where they could not work. So if they do get access to work rights in future, it could be made compulsory.
Yeah.
They could finance their own healthcare. There's no need to be reliant on our own taxpayers' money for that. And that's a pathway towards a more sustainable way of managing healthcare in this country.
But that means they need to be able to work, you know, officially, and everything else needs to be put in place.
Exactly. And I keep saying this, that, you know, the solutions for healthcare is not necessarily in the health sector. The main limiting factor in health is actually social determinants of health. And in this country, in terms of managing healthcare for these populations, it's the social determinants, the access to work. Mm-hmm. This could be the first step towards helping them access healthcare, because then they are able to access their own livelihoods and be able to decide what they do with that money and prioritize healthcare as such.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We're discussing responding to the health needs of refugees. Dr. Sushila Balasundaram, Head of Public Health Unit at UNHCR, together with Dr. Tartini Zainuddin, a child rights activist in the studio with me, helping us understand how we can better improve this access to health for undocumented as well as refugees living in this country. Up next, we'll find out a little bit more about how we're going to tackle things like the recent polio outbreak. I mean, we've not seen one in 27 years. Was there a limitation in this process that has caused that to come about? And I think we have admitted that there is. So we'll come back and find out more up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Meera Sivasodhi. We are discussing health needs of refugees in this country. Dr. Sushila Balasundaram, Head of the Public Health Unit at UNHCR, and Dr. Hartini Zainuddin, a child rights activist, in the studio with me. As we were discussing earlier, Dr. Sushila has sort of told us that there are about 178,000 refugees living in this country, a quarter of whom are children, all under the age of 18. Was it 20% that are women, did you mention?
30%
of women and girls amongst this population. My gut feel says we have far more than 178,000 people. Don't you think, Tini?
Yes,
we do.
Would
you say it's what, double?
No, I think from the community estimates, it's maybe about 30, 40,000 more. That's the figures that we've been receiving from our communities.
Okay. Tini, when you talk about, there was the first polio outbreak in Malaysia after 27 years in Sabah.
Yes, and the child was stateless, yeah.
That's right, the child was stateless. Not a refugee child, but it's stateless, undocumented.
Yes. What
did you think about that? How did you feel about that?
I actually rolled my eyes and go, here we go. This is what we were talking about, and this is what we've been advocating for, the access to, you know, basic healthcare. You know, apparently, and I'm not sure about this, the child had been vaccinated, but it wasn't completed. I think the treatment wasn't done 100%, so that was why. But the point is that, you know, there are practical and realistic reasons why, you know, parents don't send their children to government hospitals, the fear of being detained, you know, the discrimination, the orientation, the fact that there is no access to information, etc. You know, I've done this work for a long time, and last year alone, you know, we had 3 children die. And the year before that, we had 2 children die, babies all under 3 years old. And the babies who died, most of the children who died were died because they didn't have any vaccinations. And, you know, it was, you know, TB, meningitis, diphtheria and stuff, which are preventable, I think, if you had vaccines. And so, you know, we're seeing the repercussions of having archaic, horrible policies which make no sense, that disallows children to have access to basic care and protection, and because of that, children die. And it's not even that. If you want to talk about no real national security issues, the security issue should be health, because if we have a outbreak of measles and chickenpox, we're in big trouble. Yeah, because we'll have to go down to the community and provide all this information when we could have done that earlier, much earlier. So this is the reason why. I'm sorry to say I told you so. I told you so. You know?
Yes, absolutely. Dr. Sushila, so vaccinations amongst the refugee communities, how does that, is there an organised program for them, or how does that work?
Yeah. Refugees still go to the public health facilities for that. We do not have sufficient resources to start a parallel program of vaccinations. And it's been getting pretty challenging in terms of the cost again to actually access vaccinations. But I think upcoming project of that's actually supported by the Qatar government is looking into vaccinations for refugee children. They are targeting some 24,000 refugee children in this project, and we hope to get them covered in the coming year, and the duration of the project is for 3 years. But having said that, I think we still need to look again at the sustainable solution to this, mm-hmm. in that making it affordable or actually looking at investing for vaccinations as a step towards public health care for Malaysians.
But do you think, I mean, we've got a ton of NGOs in this country. Yeah. Do you think that while we get our act together on a policy level, do you think there's a possibility that NGOs could come together with UNHCR to fill this gap?
We've actually done quite a few programs in the past, actually. The only limiting factor was whether we could afford vaccines. When we did, and when we had contributions of vaccines, we actually rounded up with the help of many NGOs in Malaysia. We reached out to refugee kids around the country and actually had a whole measles vaccination campaign in the past 2 years before this. So it really depends on when we have resources. I mean, we have had NGOs available and ready to step up, you know, so that has been the practice in the past few years.
Inotini, you mentioned your work with the local children as well. You know, and you're right about the B40. We have sometimes just the cost of going to a clinic and getting vaccinated.
Expensive.
People can't afford to do that. Parents have two jobs. They don't even have the time to take their children to do this. Who understands what a, you know, the vaccination card or immunization card actually means? And when do you go?
Or if they give birth at home, you know. I mean, there's so many things that's going on, and we're not, I don't think we're looking at it intelligently in terms of policies, and I think we need to really understand and look at the issues from the ground up and not come down and you know, from the top down and just give administrative orders. We need to understand the impact on B40, you need to understand the impact on refugee and migrant and stateless children. You can't not do it because they're not Malaysian or they're poor, or because you have no access because they're in rural areas. It just does not make sense. It never has. So we need to stop it now. And there are warning signs, so we should take heed.
And, from our practice in the past also, I feel that the refugees really appreciate that they are able to access vaccinations. Sometimes they've not had this chance in their own country where health systems are not functional, or they may not have had access because of persecution where they were. But, you know, at a time when they could afford it, I could just walk into any of the refugee households, pick up their vaccination card, and almost all complete. And that was at the time when they could afford vaccinations. And they were very, very appreciative that they could actually access vaccinations. So I think if we make it affordable, the push is just, again, community campaigns to inform them, and they will go ahead.
The irony is that how one group is quite willing to get vaccinated, then you have another group doesn't want to be vaccinated. And it's the same problem. It's a national security issue, don't you think, Tina?
Absolutely.
Vaccinations.
And I think people, maybe Malaysians who are against vaccinations, are too far removed from the realities of what happens when you don't have vaccine. They have not seen outbreaks as, you know, we have seen in certain refugee operations outside. And you know, the amount of morbidity and mortality that incurs, and the cost in actually containing such, and actually, you know, to see kids just die from something that's so easily preventable from a very affordable vaccine.
And, you know, I've always said, for those who can afford it and who have access to it, the more you don't vaccinate, the more vulnerable this group becomes, because they are unable to vaccinate for all these reasons that you've just spoken about. The herd immunity just goes down as a result. So what about sensitization of healthcare workers? I mean, are they quite open to you know, helping refugee children or refugees in hospitals and public healthcare facilities?
There are a couple of foundations that are looking at funding organisations and UN organisations who actually work on training and upskilling community healthcare workers. So I'm hoping that they go out and do more work and fund more programmes like that, because I think that's what we need. If we don't have enough, it's the same with child protection and stuff. You know, if you don't have enough alternative child protectors and you don't have enough community healthcare workers, then go out and train the community. And I think that's the best form of empowerment. You allow them to work. You allow them, give them the information. You give them access to resources. I think they can take care of themselves, you know, but we need to allow this to happen, and we haven't.
Healthcare workers.
I think over this past 10, 12 years that I've in UNHCR, we've been going out to a lot of the hospitals around the country to actually talk to them about who refugees are, for healthcare workers to understand where they're coming from, you know. And usually when they understand the situations, they're much more compassionate about assisting and more willing to pick up the phone and call us if they have any issues. But it is very, very resource draining in terms of having to reach out to every hospital and to keep this going. So, but there's no two ways about it. We still continue to sensitize, and we actually involve a lot of the healthcare providers in some of our coordination meetings so they get a better sense of and an understanding of what's required in the area of refugee health.
Where is the knowledge gap? What is it that they don't understand about refugees?
I think the problem is also we have a huge population of undocumented persons, of course, which includes migrants, and they tend to conflate the issues, and they don't understand that refugees come from a different background and may have different needs, different protection needs. Hence, you know, when you talk to them about it, they understand better and are able to, you know, be more understanding when they're providing services. So I think it's just that the conflation of them with the others, you know, the fact that, foreigners, you know, they're all in this one whole group that we should not be providing services to. But having said that, coming from the healthcare sector, I think we still also need to actually advocate for more inclusive healthcare in looking at ways to actually be more inclusive in line with the SDGs. You know, we can look at systems that actually support financing of healthcare, you know, for these populations.
Totally agree. So one of the things that we've been doing, especially since baby started dying on my watch, is that we're actually going around talking to private hospitals, and we're talking to doctors and pharmaceutical companies and just people in general who want to help, to try to pull all our resources together to sort of support what the Ministry of Health is doing, but to specifically support B40 vulnerable children and babies from me, and, you know, and to try to see how we can collectively do something and help the children, so that we don't have situations where there are emergency or children dying, you know. We stop that. So I've sort of gone around with doctors, speaking to corporates in hospitals one by one for the last year, trying to pull them all together and say, what can you give us? Can you give us vaccines for free? Can you give us beds? Can you give us doctors, volunteer doctors' times? Versus what can you give us? And so we've been doing that, you know, and trying to get a good group together. And we're doing pretty well. I think we just need to do more. I've sort of set a mental deadline to get something going to help more than one child a year, because the work that we're doing from the NGO perspective, from YCK's perspective, is, you know, we can help 2-3 children a year. That's not enough.
No. How will it's you? Not enough. How will you get the NGOs together, Tina? How
honestly,
will you get them to rally behind you?
I am so frustrated in many ways as well. I think there are NGOs who work well together, but there are NGOs who are very territorial about who they are and why they exist. And yes, funding is important, but I think we could do so much better and have much more impact if we work together and, you know, look to the UNHCR for directions if it's refugees, like, you know, but just be allowed to work together, you know, understand what our objectives are and forget all this infighting, territorial funding issues that we have, and just say, look, for the children, for the sake of our children, just please, let's just work together. And what do you have? And just pull it together. And I know UNHCR has a lot of work on their plate, but, you know, just help guide us, like, what do we do, and, you know, how do we expand the fund that you already have, if you have, you know, and the resources so that we can just help as many children as possible. And if they're not refugees, then, you know, how do we help the other children? But I think we need to work together on a lot of issues, and this bickering, backfighting kind of thing that happens with some NGOs, that has to stop. And that the government doesn't see us as a threat or something that's a body that's different, but an extension of the work that they're doing. We're here to help. We're not here to make things worse. And we just want everybody in Malaysia to be healthy. I think we should all just sit down and, you know, look at, map out what needs to happen, what are the resources we have, and just pull everything together and align everything, all the programs, funds, resources we have, and just align it with what's best for children.
So we're lacking a coordinating body?
Oh, yeah. Team? For sure, in every pillar,
who
whether
ideally,
it's education, health, etc.
Who should lead this?
We have to decide. You know, if it's refugees, then UNHCR. I think UNHCR, sorry, but I think UNHCR should.
Yeah, I think we already have some level of coordination structures with our healthcare providers, mm-hmm. as well as the stakeholders, whether they are directly implementing programs or indirectly. So we meet regularly. We have stakeholder meetings with them. They are contributing in their different ways. And at least if they let us know what they are doing, then we are able to at mm-hmm. least coordinate services. For example, if an NGO is able to provide services and we are able to match that with areas where we know there are no NGOs providing services, that really helps. If not, they're really just then duplicating services in an area where they're already well served.
Mm.
So, but sometimes NGOs do not come to us. They have their own initiative. They do not coordinate with us. And then that makes it a challenge then to actually know who's providing what out there. But I think maybe some structures in terms of a public-private mix and the NGO sector as well needs to be probably established to actually enhance this coordination, because right now we are directly working with some civil society NGOs, but also increasingly involving a lot of the private sector as well, a sector which I think we can still tap into to assist in this area.
Tini, how active have Malaysian corporates been in terms of championing, you know, refugee children, or whether they're migrant workers, or whether they're undocumented people or stateless children, the B40, how open are corporates to collaborating and contributing towards this cause?
There are a couple of corporates that's the go-to corporates that would actually help anybody who needs help.
The usual suspects.
The usual suspects. If you can't go to other corporates who may or may not know the work that you're doing or would like to be introduced, they will always quote the constitution of the foundation that says you cannot work with non-Malaysians or provide services. And I just think that that's just such a shame, that we should be looking at ways in which we can sort of work together, change that policy, whatever it is, with the tax department or whatever, and try to figure out ways to just make sure that it's really about what's best for children in Malaysia. I'm just talking about children. I just don't get it, because some foundations will help anybody who needs help, as long as you have a good, solid funding proposal. And some others just will quote that constitution. And we need to figure out how to get by that or get around it or work with it to ensure that everybody's helped. And everybody includes refugees, migrants and stateless.
When there is an outbreak, Dr. Sushila, what actually happens?
We've been working very closely with the ground level service providers in terms of the state health authorities. So when there's an outbreak, we normally liaise with the state health authorities. And if they need be, we help them link to our refugee committees to do the mop-up vaccinations. So part of our other work would be to actually reach out to our refugee communities in terms of information, what to do, where to access healthcare in terms of outbreak. But previously, it's been... since there is a functional health system here, so we normally liaise with them and take lead from them for that.
So let's take the Batik community in mm-hmm. Kelantan for an example. When there was a measles outbreak, mm-hmm. how was that managed?
I think for the Batik community, it's more of the local indigenous.
Yep.
So it's within the Ministry of Health. They have their own structures to manage that. In terms of reaching out to other communities, there's usually more localized to the area of the outbreak. If there are refugees in that area, then they will try to reach out to them through us. If not, if they are not able to reach out, then they might reach out to NGOs to assist. But in general, when outbreaks like this happen, they do mop up, and they do mop up for all children.
I will give you an example of a couple of outbreaks, and we're not talking about measles, etc. We're just talking about chickenpox. So we had a few times had outbreaks of chickenpox with our children in our centres. We had to shut down all our centres, put the children in isolation, go into their community, and you know and teach the parents how to boil their bed sheets and, you know, take the medicine and do all these different things. And, you know, a lot of these parents and families live in urban settings, which are small little houses with no bathrooms. And I don't know where we're going to boil water and boil bed sheets and hang them up, you know. So we've got issues here in terms of providing information and also adjusting to the context, to the situation. Poor families, B40 families in low-cost housing don't have kitchens and bathrooms in every apartment. Some of them, they're in 10-foot by 8-foot places in Chowkit. There's no place for them to boil their bed sheets and hang them up. And there's, you know what, if parents work 2-3 jobs, they're not going to be able to give the meds. So if NGOs have to do it, then we need to try to work together to see how we get what the best information and sort of divvy out. But that's how we do it. We get an outbreak of chickenpox, we shut down. We have an outbreak of lice. Don't even talk about measles. We shut down. That's how it works because we've got nothing.
Those are just minor examples. I mean, What more if it were measles and something more
serious?
And
that's urban, you know, where it can spread really fast.
Absolutely. Okay. We're discussing responding to the health needs of refugees. And, you know, of course, with Tini here, it's just people who are marginalised, really, the healthcare needs of these people. We'll come back and find out about refugees and their mental health needs. You have mentioned refugees are different from the migrant communities. Mm. We'll come back and find out what exactly those differences are. And I can imagine the mental health conditions that need attending to is dire. That's coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Mira Sivisodi. In our Health and Living segment today, we are responding to the health needs of refugees, is the discussion. Dr. Sushila Balasundaram, head of the Public Health Unit at UNHCR, and Dr. Hartini Zainuddin, a child rights activist in the studio with us to discuss refugees and, you know, minorities and marginalised people when it comes to healthcare. Dr. Sushila, let's talk about the mental health needs of a refugee. You mentioned earlier for sensitisation of healthcare workers, there needs to be proper education about who a refugee really is, who a migrant worker really is. There is a difference and they need to be educated on this. Tell us a little bit about the refugee and how different this person is from a migrant worker, for an example, and what are some of their mental health needs?
Well, refugee by definition is already that they are persecuted. They have probably come from areas of war, conflict, so you can imagine that they have already been through highly traumatizing situations. They may have witnessed atrocities. They themselves may have been personally survivors of certain atrocities. But having said that, I think it'll be useful to take the path of a refugee's flight from the time that they're in a home country whereby they're witnessing all these atrocities, war, conflict or human rights abuses, and then on to the flight itself where they could continue to be subjected to maybe torture from smugglers, traffickers, or the path that they take flight on is actually highly traumatizing as well. Or at the time when they come to a country of asylum where they continue to be in difficult protection environments where they're not able to access a lot of the basic needs. So all these have a role to play in the mental health of a refugee. It may be the past persecution or even present ongoing stresses on a daily level because of the difficulty in the lives they lead. And so we do see a lot of mild to moderate stress and anxiety levels in the refugees. We do see depression cases, of course, having to deal with what's in the past and yet having to go on with life as difficult as it is at the present moment. So we are not able to deal with the more general anxiety levels. We try to that we have to deal with more general psychoeducation to how to cope in the current environment, not even to relieve what is happening, but how to cope, how to get by. For the more difficult cases, then we have to look at how counselling can help. And we are also in Malaysia, we do not have a lot of structures that provide or services, a lot of mental health services. Even for Malaysians, we are lacking such services. And therefore, for refugees, even more dire. And the number of psychologists that are actually experienced in actually dealing with such difficult trauma cases are very few. And hence, it's also the first time they're actually dealing with such severe cases. So we do face a lot of challenge in terms of managing mental health, particularly serious mental health disorders. Not that it's a lot. We don't have that many cases in terms of numbers of severe mental health disorders, but it's more the more general, moderate and mild cases that may still need a lot of support, given that, you know, they continue to live in this kind of difficult environment.
Do these issues differ from age group, based on age group?
Not necessarily.
It cuts across all.
But it may present differently in different age groups. Children may not openly say they need mental health services, but it may reflect in the way they behave in school. You know, they may be having learning difficulties, behavioral difficulties, and that's one of the areas that we have actually touched on in this past 2 years, where we actually collaborated with one of the local NGOs, Health Equities Initiatives, to run a program on trauma-informed care, to train teachers to be able to identify some of these behavioral issues so that children may be able to be identified early and provided the supportive services in terms of behavioral therapy.
I'm going to talk about a specific case right now. So we have a two-year-old Yemeni refugee child. I don't know if he's registered with UNHCR or not yet. But the father is a surgeon, actually, in his own country, who actually specializes in prosthetics. And he works a lot. Anyway, he fled Yemen for whatever reason. And he had a child and with this woman. The woman, the wife, ran off and left this two-year-old child. But she had abused this child as well, really physically and mentally quite badly. And the father was trying to look for odd jobs, which for me is just the most tragic because he's a surgeon and couldn't take care of this child because he's out working at all hours. So here, through a friend, they got hold of me and said, could you please take care of my child because I can't even feed him. And this was through an interpreter. And so when the child came, we noticed that he had behavioral problems. He was sleeping on the table or under the table, and you can't touch his face to wash it or brush his teeth because the mother, who I guess was traumatized, and had smashed his face against the wall. So his teeth were old and his gums were damaged. You couldn't wash his hair because the mother had pulled his hair under the shower, so you can't touch his head. And so we thought he was autistic because, you know, he couldn't speak, he couldn't talk.
Did you say he was two?
And he's two. And so we have volunteers. We're lucky because we have volunteers who are professionals. And one of our volunteers is a child psychologist who specializes in trauma. And so she took a hold. She examined him and realized, called me up and said, he's not autistic. He's just neglected because of the trauma. And he hasn't had any communication with anybody. But if you spend time, an hour a day, just talking to him and saying, it's going to get better. And so it's been a month later and the child is learning his ABCs and he's not sleeping on the table anymore and you still can't touch him. We just got him a new pair of shoes. But he's learning to talk and verbalize. And, you know, so these are the kind of things that happen to refugee children because the parents are trying to look for odd jobs because they cannot work, because they have no home, because they have no family, because, you know, these children are sometimes by themselves and, you know, abused and traumatized. The parents are traumatized and, you know, and just with a little bit of help and volunteers, you know, the child can thrive and not just survive. And it's so important. And for me, I think it's the most heartbreaking but heartwarming situation because we could help. And mental health is, these two-year-olds cannot verbalize what's going on. They can just tell you, don't touch them.
As Dr. Susila said, it's all about the social determinants of health. It's just not health. It's got, it's linked to so many other things as well. And if you could put your finger on just one thing, Dr. Susila, where do you think these problems are coming from? Where does it stem from? This whole issue that we have of access to healthcare, the social determinants that determine, you know, health for refugees. If you could change this one place or the source, where would this source be? And we're going to hold this source accountable after this show.
I think the current government came into power with Manifesto 35, stating that they will have provide work rights to refugees, and that would be a first step. But I think really it is looking at a proper legislation and a system to actually manage refugees, whether in terms of the legality of the status or access to work or access to healthcare. It just needs to be managed.
Tini?
For me, it's quite simple. I think you just need to look at people as people, children as children, and that they're entitled to not give. They're entitled to all the protection and rights that every single child in Malaysia has, Malaysian children or not, that they deserve protection and rights, equal, same access. And when we start treating people as people, I think we'd do a lot better. So forget the policies, you know, change all of that and just make sure that everybody in Malaysia is safe and happy. And yes, right to work, number one, because then you empower and you give them dignity. Because
you know,
we don't have that now.
We always look at policymakers. We always look at government, you know, to help ease this process a little. How much does the Malaysian public play a role?
They need to know that these are people who have fled their countries. They didn't come here, choose to come here because it's the land of opportunity. They came here because they're fleeing violence and they're fleeing persecution. So let's just be clear about that, right? Nobody comes here because they want to when we're talking about refugees. So you need to understand that they need help. And out of humanity and out of the fact that we, you know, we should help one another, that's something that we need to look at. And the fact is they're here, they're not going anywhere, not and for a while. So we need to do something and make them feel safe and protect them. And yeah.
Yeah, I echo that, in that public needs to understand where refugees are coming from, to connect with them on a very human being level, so that they know if they actually take the path, walk the path of a refugee, then they totally will understand what they have been through. And then ask themselves how they can help.
How would you describe the Malaysian mindset now when it comes to refugees?
I think that's a bit divided, I would say. There are some who go all out to help refugees. They really do a lot for refugees. But yet there are those who don't see them as others, taking what we Malaysians have and, you know, taking our jobs. And so there's just, a lack of understanding, a lack of information as to what refugees are actually going through in Malaysia. I think there are some who misunderstand that they are even provided a bit allowance by the government. So there's a lot of misinformation out there. So I think starting with the accurate, factual information about what refugees are going through may be helpful for the public to understand. Yeah. And then maybe we can see some change in terms of how they perceive refugees or whether they are willing to assist or go out of the way. That's a different story. But
it's
the first step.
In my mind, Malaysians need to be sensitised when it comes to this. Just not the healthcare workers, but we as a society. Tini?
Yeah. I think you know, we need to realise they're people. They're parents with children or children with parents or no parents, who are here because of circumstances, and that it is our duty and obligation to help. And that, you know, they didn't come here because they wanted to. They came here out of necessity, and that we need to help and protect and make them feel safe and secure and empowered. Then they can go elsewhere. But if you don't give them right to work, you don't give them access to health, you don't give them access to education, you don't give them, you know, how are they supposed to leave?
And who knows, that surgeon could contribute to the Malaysian healthcare system.
Yeah, I'm hoping.
Exactly.
They don't have to leave. Some may not have to leave,
yeah,
you know.
I think
that's one thing too, that the public needs to understand, that refugees can make a positive contribution.
Absolutely.
Not just to the economy, but in all other sectors. Because refugees are not, you can't brand refugees as plantation workers or, you know.
Exactly.
There are professionals, there are, you know, cardiologists, you know, urologists among refugees. So they come from a whole different sector, you know, cut across different sectors of population that comes to Malaysia. Yeah. So there's a lot of potential in actually providing them access to work rights across, and they could contribute very positively.
So what I'm hearing is access to work. Yes. Priority now.
Yes.
Yes.
And then hopefully then, you know, things will move along from there.
Well, in health and education. Yeah. And yes.
But social
yes.
determinants work. Yes.
Exactly. Yes. Social First. Determinants starts yes. with that.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Would you have a message for us, Dr. Sushila, on responding to the health needs of refugees?
I think as Malaysians, as I said earlier, understand, connect, and then reach out to help.
Tini?
I'll echo her because she said it quite well, actually. Okay. I'll echo Dr. Sushila.
Thank you both very much for joining me today. Dr. Sushila Balasundaram, Head of the Public Health Unit, UNHCR, and Dr. Hartini Zainuddin, a child rights activist, speaking to us about responding to the health needs of refugees on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.